listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right On Radio.
All right. Hi, folks. Today on Right On Radio, I have David Haakonson and their new book, Her Place in the Woods, The Life of Helen Hoover. Thank you so much for joining us today, David.
I'm happy to be here, Emma. Thank you.
Awesome. So what I wanted to know about is, what made you think about writing about Helen Hoover's biography? What was like the thought process behind that?
Yeah, interesting question, because I've been asked that by a lot of my friends. Helen Hoover was this sort of beloved nature writer who lived up on Gunflint Lake in the 1950s and 60s. And she was quite successful, best-selling, wrote four books for the adult market and three for the juvenile market. And at the time, they were all bestsellers. People knew of her. But in the years since then, and since she moved away from Gunflint Lake, her reputation is sort of diminished. And I was looking around after reading her books for a biography, thinking I might find one, and didn't. So I started looking around thinking, there's got to be more about this woman. And I discovered some material at the Minnesota Historical Society that pointed me to UMD, where her papers were in their archives and special collections. So I took a dive into all of that and was convinced that her story was very interesting and needed to be told.
Awesome. So the kind of follow-up question is, like, when you went up to the, how was the research for this? Like, was it pretty easy to go to the UMD market? Were there any other sources you were looking for while looking into her biography?
Yeah, there were a lot of interesting sources. UMD obviously was the primary resource because her papers are there. But what first got me pointed in that direction was this paper at the History Center in St. Paul. And it was a master's thesis that this woman had written for her MFA at Hamline University. And she was in her 60s when she wrote it. She had passed away. I tracked down her daughter through her obituary just to see if they had donated her research to a library. And woman said to me, her daughter said to me, I still have all the research and I'd be happy to let you take a look at it. So I had that. I had what was at UMD. And then from there, it was a matter of pulling in things that I learned about from the UMD collection, which was her publisher was Alfred Knopf, well-known publishing company. All of their corporate papers were in the Ransom Center at the University of Texas at Austin. And so I was able to get a lot of material from that related to her. And then she had some correspondence with some other writers, and one in particular was a science fiction writer who had donated all of her papers to Syracuse University. And they had all of Helen's correspondence with this author in their collection. So I was really able to sort of pull together this mosaic of information to pull from.
Cool. For like somebody like me, I didn't know much about Helen Hoover at all. I was born in 95, so way past that demographic. And like my introduction to, I want to say like maybe 60s environmentalism is mostly through Rachel Carson in Silent Spring. I'm from Pittsburgh, so like she also went to school there. She has a bridge named after her. So like that's my introduction to that era of environmentalism. And Helen Hoover was just, don't even know if that was an option until like I moved here or like read about the book. So I'm curious, you've mentioned, I do believe like you read all of her books. When you were reading her books and then doing the biography, what was like the most exciting thing about that? Did you find like, oh, this is what she was writing about, or like more insights to her writing style while doing the biography?
Yes. And the fact that you mentioned Rachel Carson is interesting because they didn't necessarily know about each other, but Helen was certainly aware of Carson, who wouldn't be, because she wrote Silent Spring. And that was sort of a seminal book that launched the whole environmental movement in this country. And that was in 1962. Helen, when she had first moved up to Gunflint Lake in 1954, she had been a scientist in Chicago. And she really was not happy that the county sprayed the side roads with DDT to kill the grass and to keep the weeds down. So she would complain to the county officials through letters to the editor in the Cook County News Herald in Grand Marais about this. And she also wrote to legislators and also the Department of Conservation, which is what it was called then, and even to her congressman complaining about this, and got some of the spraying to be stopped. And so she was aware, you know, she read the Scientific American, she read some other journals like that. So she was very much on top of what Rachel Carson was doing. But to your question about her writing style, because she had been a scientist and because she loved to write, she had a very good observational powers and the ability for patience, and she had plenty of time to sit in her cabin and watch animals outside their door that they fed with, you know, bird seed and other things, and just kind of watch their environment and observe it, and then start to write about the things that she learned. And it wasn't only just looking at things. She got reference books and other things which helped inform her about animal behavior, and that all sort of influenced her writing. So it was very much a, I'm going to tell you about what I saw and what I observed, and I'm also going to remind you that man can't control nature. We have to coexist with it. And that sort of message comes through in all of her books for the adult market, which are each one are a little bit different.
Yeah, and like kind of elaborating on the writing style, what I found fascinating while reading the book was she would anthropomorphize her animals, like Peter the Buck. And I don't know of any contemporary natural scientist who does that. And I wonder if you can elaborate to our listeners more why she did that and kind of how that was different from her contemporaries at the time.
Yeah, and that was particularly from the book The Gift of the Deer, which was her second book published in 1966. And she took that accusation about anthropomorphizing her books very personally and didn't agree with it. I think part of it with The Gift of the Deer, she named all of these deer, and I think people thought that that was sort of, you know, a little bit too sentimental. But when you're trying to describe deer to a reader, you can't say deer number one, deer number two, deer number three. You know, you have to give them names, so, or some way of, you know, ascribing who they are. So she did that. But I think what was important is that if you read between the lines on that particular book and others, she still gets at the core of their animal behavior and observes it and tries to interpret it for humans. And she goes up to that line where, you know, some writers will say that, you know, an animal did something like this that we think about in human terms, but there's no way that they can behave that way because they're not humans. She kind of went up to that line, and I think she masked her ability not to cross it by perhaps just explaining what she saw rather than editorializing on what she saw. So she did get some criticism for it, but she also had her editor who didn't agree with that and asked her to write about that in her third book, which she did in the foreword. And she sort of beat back her critics about that particular topic.
I never thought about that. One of the things I really like kind of resonated with her story was a woman being in a male-dominated environment, especially being the metallurgist, I believe is how the
Yes, that's
yeah.
correct.
And I'm kind of curious when doing the biography, writing the biography, did she have like any like extraordinary insights on being in a male-dominated environment that our listeners would like to know, and like kind of how that shaped her personality and her perseverance?
Yes, I think that's a great question. You know, I think looking back at it, when you look at sort of the birth of the feminism movement, which was often attributed to Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique in 1964, you know, Helen had been working in metallurgy, which is not a women's field at all. You know, it's the study of understanding different properties in metals. And she was working at International Harvester, a big farm implement company. And actually during World War II, she had a series of jobs at testing labs where she learned a lot and was self-taught because she didn't have a college degree. She had only gone to college for 2 years. And I think that, and then landing this really plum job at International Harvester and dealing with this particular problem they had with how steel was treated, and she solved it and had got a patent for the research that she did. I think that was very unusual for the time. And I think because she had a high IQ, even though she wasn't formally tested, it's very apparent through some of her correspondence and some of her self-awareness that she had a high IQ, that she just was not, you know, she just was not aware of, you know, sort of the conflicts. And she was sort of above it all, even though the fact that she knew that she was not liked because she didn't have a college degree or an advanced degree, or that she was smart and that she solved this problem, and that she had men and colleagues along the way putting up various roadblocks and ways to sort of sabotage her career, if you will. And once she had solved this problem and got the patent, she felt like she'd accomplished all she wanted to do, and she quit and walked away from that job and decided to move up to Gunflint Lake with her husband and start another career, hopefully writing. And at the beginning, it was difficult. She started with magazine work and then children's writing, and then it morphed into getting contracts to do books, and she had a really successful second career.
What I really like is also the collaboration with her husband, who was the illustrator for those books, correct?
That's correct. Adrian illustrated all of her books.
I think that's just such a cute, that's just a cute couple story. That's like, to me, ideal couples goals.
Well, it was interesting because when they first moved up there, he was supposed to get a contract to do artwork by mail with a client in Chicago. And what happened was they had a car accident. He couldn't get to the appointment in Duluth. He lost the contract, and then they were sort of stuck to figure out what to do. And Helen came up with the idea, because he was an artist, that he could do things like notepaper and stationery that they could sell, that they could produce and sell to like gift shops and others up in that area of the state. And then eventually she placed an ad in one of the nature magazines, Audubon, to sell the stationery. So what they essentially did was ran a mail order business out of their house. And the other thing was is that the way they reproduced the art on notepaper is that it was done on a mimeograph, and you have to be a certain age to remember what a mimeograph is, but it's a duplicating device, and it doesn't require electricity, which they did not have at the cabin. It's done by a hand cranking process. So they were able to do that work by hand without electricity and make a living until, and then at the same time, Helen discovered that she was really adept at writing short stories about animals in the woods near their cabin and in their yard. And she started submitting those to nature magazines, and they started paying her $35 and $50 a throw. And they started to sort of, Adrian had his job and she had hers, and they were both really, really successful with that.
Yeah, I want to touch base on what you mentioned about the lack of electricity in the cabin. I'm kind of curious, how was it writing the biography and learning the hardships of cabin ownership in where they didn't have electricity or running water? And it didn't sound like Helen had a lot of experience experience with this sort of kind of environment. And I wonder if you can elaborate that with our listeners.
Yes, it is interesting. They bought the cabin in 1948, and they spent several summers going up to it, like a lot of people do, spending their 2 week summer at the cabin. When they decided to move there permanently, what they hadn't thought about is you're going to have to live there year round, and they'd never been there in the late fall or winter. So they didn't really think through what they were getting into. And it didn't have running water. They pulled their water out of Gunflint Lake and brought it up to the cabin in buckets. They didn't have electricity. At the beginning, they had an electric plant. It was like a wind generator, but it worked intermittently, and then it eventually didn't work. They did have an oil burning furnace, a small one, and a cook stove, but neither one of them were capable of keeping the house warm all winter at the types of temperatures that you find up at the end of the Gunflint Trail. So, and they also didn't hunt and they didn't fish. So they weren't able to, eat fish or shoot deer and live off of that because it just was against their principles. So they really were kind of in really naive about what it was going to take to live there. And they encountered a lot of challenges. They had help from some of the neighbors and friends there, but having been two people who lived through the Depression in the 1930s, a lot of people then couldn't rely on anybody for help. There just wasn't help. You had to bootstrap yourself and take care of yourself. And I think part of that sort of survival mentality that they had from the years of the Depression, which were difficult for both of them before they got married, sort of carried over into their life up in the North Woods.
Yeah, I also want to when you mentioned about like working with, because they didn't take any hunted goods or like they didn't hunt or fish. And I remember reading in the book, Helen had as like some confrontations with like the local hunters and around that area. I was wondering if you can like expand upon why that was and just like kind of the contention that she had with like the local community initially when her and her husband moved up there.
Yeah, they I think one of the things is they started to feed deer and other animals, and the deer would come back, and I don't want to say they were domesticated, but they certainly were going to go where there was a food source. And they did this over several years, and I think Helen talked about it with some of her neighbors. And then the lodges and resorts nearby, which catered to deer hunters in the fall before they closed for the season, certainly were keen on the fact that Helen was feeding all these deer and they were fattening them up. And they had no compunction about saying that there were deer in the area that were being fed by somebody locally. I think what Helen, and rightly so, was angry about is that their property was posted not no trespassing and no hunting, and hunters just didn't pay any attention to that and went on their land to shoot. It was more of a Wild West mindset back in those days than it is today. It was far north on the Gunflint Trail. It wasn't nearly as developed, so I just think there was less mental restrictions on where people went to hunt. I just think they kind of thought it was the North Woods and everything's fair game. And so when they came onto their property and shot some of the deer that Helen had been writing about, she was very distressed by that, and it really upset her. And really, the fact that so many of the deer that they fed that were featured in the book were eventually shot and killed was really the impetus for her to put that story to paper and write it. And she wanted to do it in a way that, that sort of honored and memorialized the deer in that book.
Huh, that's pretty interesting, because I thought yeah, and especially like the way she immortalized it with like naming the deer, because it always does feel like it's kind of a childish thing to like name like your backyard rabbits, gophers. There's a raccoon that lives in my backyard, and I just like calling him, I think, oh God, I think his name changes every month or so. But it does make it kind of fun though. It's like, okay, there's Glenn again, I guess. I always find that really interesting. But I was going to like kind of bring us back into modern times with Helen Hoover's writing. I'm wondering like what can modern audiences, or for those like in my generation, I did not grow up with Helen Hoover. What can we take away from her writing, especially now currently with environmentalism as a more of a upstanding issue now than it was then?
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about nature writing in general is that it doesn't age. We still read Thoreau's Walden. That was written, what, a couple hundred years ago. And subsequent to that, there's been other nature writers, John Muir, Sigurd Olson from Minnesota. There's others that have written about it. Nature never goes out of style. It doesn't change, other than we are impacted by things like climate change and those sorts of things. But you can still write an observation about deer today, or in 1950 when Helen wrote about it, or in 1825 when Jack London wrote about it. So I think you can. I think the thing about Helen that's good is this sort of through line, that's sort of in between the stories she tells about being very, very clear that man cannot control nature, and we never will be able to do that. And we need to coexist with animals and their environment and our environment in a way that preserves it for the future. So I think if you read her that way, you will find her still relevant, even though there's some nostalgic aspects to not having electricity or running water and things like that.
Yeah, because it's always kind of sometimes I do feel I'm mostly an urban city dweller, so when I always read stories of folks like up in the cabin or things like that, I just never really I sometimes it doesn't feel like it clicks, but I always really like reading the stories of nature writers because it does transport me into those areas and that kind of mindset that makes it easier for me to digest nature writing, quite frankly. That's kind of the thing I always find interesting. Mine my question, because it's kind of a fun question. Was there a particular book of Helen that you found that you really liked? Of her four books that she wrote for mostly adults? Is there
I
one?
think the one that sparked the most was her third book, A Place in the Woods. And that's really the story, the first of her four books that's more autobiographical. And what it does is it tells the story of them wanting to find a cabin in the North Woods and traveling all over Wisconsin and Upper Michigan and then finally Minnesota. and then buying it, and then all the things that I've talked about that they just didn't anticipate. And she does it in a self-deprecating way. So you, as a reader like yourself, who's only an urban dweller, like they were, can kind of, understand where she's coming from. Because I think all of us as humans have a fantasy, that we'd like to just walk away from our jobs and go live in a cabin or go sit on a beach or do something and not have to deal with the modern world and all the challenges that come with it. So I think that book really captures sort of her style and storytelling and nature observation in a way that is really captivating.
I always find it because it does, like, her life just sounds like basically my fantasy of, like, yeah, I'll just quit my job and go live in a cabin in the woods. And it's like, I cannot believe somebody actually just basically did
Yeah,
that.
and I think that's a big part of her appeal is that she and her husband walked away from two very well-paying jobs in Chicago, big city, and did what a lot of people fantasize about doing, and they did it successfully, which I think makes the stories obviously a lot more interesting.
Yeah, what I'm kind of curious of is what is up, is her cabin still available like for tourism up in the Gunflint Lake, or is there still like kind of a tourism economy around her in that
There
area?
really isn't. I think this book is going to spark one, to be honest, because there's a lot of people I encountered that have, vaguely remember her or know of her from local folklore. But, the cabins, one of them had to get torn down. Another one has been heavily modified and they're in private ownership. So there's really not any way to see them. But she definitely, is sparked some interest. I was just up talking at the Chickwack Nature Center recently, and there was about 60 people there, and most all of them had heard of Helen or knew about her, but hadn't really understood her context in the times that she lived. So that seems to be something that's sort of sparking a reawakening in her in interest in her writing.
Okay, that's perfect. I'm gonna wrap it up here, David. Do you mind reading a little bit of the book? It's from
Yeah,
the last bit of the novel, and David's gonna read us a bit of a section.
thank you. This is from the last chapter of the book. Helen had said she wanted to lead three lives, one in a bucolic small town where she grew up, another in an urban environment where her mind would be challenged by work, and finally one in a place of peace and solitude where she could write. She accomplished all of these and so much more in the process, carving out her own unique niche among nature writers. She had the ability to connect with her readers in a natural way, and her books were bestsellers in the genre. Reader's Digest would not have purchased the rights to three of her books if she had not have this special appeal. In a sense, her books captured the spirit of the nascent 1960s environmental movement that was stirred by Rachel Carson, which led to a broader desire for a back to the land sensibility, fed by a society yearning to be more connected to nature and removed from the challenges of modern life. Helen's professional life as a metallurgist always had its challenges, especially as a woman working in a field dominated by men. One can imagine how odd it must have been in the 1950s endeavoring to fix a disc harrow problem that had vexed a large agricultural implement company for decades, a problem eventually solved by Helen, a woman. Self-trained and without a college degree, and achieved a patent for her discovery. That alone would have been the pinnacle of most careers. But for Helen, it was not. The dream of that young girl in Greenfield, Ohio, to live where she wanted and not be bothered while she read and wrote about what she saw, came true. As she said so eloquently in the last paragraph of her final book, The Years of the Forest, I knew that I had found what all men seek, my place in the world of my time.
Oh, thank you so much for that reading, David. This was David Hakenson with Her Place in the Woods, The Life of Helen Hoover. And David, you will be at Majors & Quinn Booksellers Tuesday, September 30th, correct?
That's correct at 7 p.m.
Awesome. So catch David at Majors & Quinn, 7 p.m., September 30th. I believe that will be next week. And thank you so much for joining Ride On Radio. And now this.
Support for KFAI comes from The Dakota, presenting Karen Allison Thursday, December 11th. Jazz vocalist Karen Allison brings her latest release to the Dakota stage. A Kiss for Brazil is a love letter to Brazilian performers like Luiz Bonfá and Antonio Carlos Jobim. More information about Karen Allison is available at dakotacooks.com.
Winter is here. Ramsey County winter warming spaces are open every night between 9 p.m. and 7 a.m. now through March. These spaces are available to anyone in need of a place to warm up overnight. If you or someone you know need a place to warm up overnight, call 651-266-1035 between 5 p.m. and 5 a.m. That's 651-266-1035. To find out more, visit ramseycounty.us/warming spaces.
Support for KFAI comes from The Cedar, presenting Ben Cookfeltz's Holiday Shindig, Sunday, December 14th. Singer, songwriter, multi-instrumentalist, and long-lost elf, Ben Cookfeltz hosts his fifth annual Holiday Shindig at The Cedar, a family-friendly event benefiting Rain in Sarcoma. The show will feature seasonal classics, playful spins on holiday favorites, and selections from his 2020 release, BCF in Christmas. Opening the show are Ann Reed and Zippy Lasky. More information about Ben Cookfeltz's Holiday Shindig is available at thecedar.org.
You're listening to KFAI on 90.3 FM in Minneapolis and streaming on the web at kfai.org. Welcome to Right On Radio.
All right. Hi, everybody. Welcome to Right On Radio. Today, I have Christina Baldwin, the artistic director of the Jungle Theater and the director and co-creator of Dinner for One. Thank you so much for joining us, Christina.
Well, thanks, Emma, for having me.
So can you explain Dinner for One for our audiences here?
You bet. It is inspired by an old vaudeville slapstick sketch comedy piece from the 20s. And it became an iconic film. It's like the film version. There are a couple versions going around. One's like 9 minutes long. One is about 12 minutes long. And it essentially follows a butler who is helping make a dinner party happen for the woman he works for. And it's she's in an advanced age where she has outlived all of her friends. So he is making this party happen, a dinner party, but has been called into service to drink all the cocktails that are served at this party, and hijinks ensue. But I first found this piece because it is it's this much beloved little sketch comedy that's played on repeat in Germany and a lot of Scandinavian countries and all over in various pockets of Europe, and various folks, like this is like a New Year's tradition, like It's a Wonderful Life sometimes is ubiquitous on American TV or things like that, you know. And so I was touring the American Swedish Institute quite a few years ago now, maybe 5 years ago, with a friend and director at the time, Bruce Karstedt, and one of the theme rooms, and you know, they're fully decked out for the holidays. It's just such a cool place to visit at the holidays. And they had one room there where they had this old TV and they were playing this sketch comedy on loop. And I couldn't take my eyes off it. And he's like, let's go to the next room. And I'm like, nope, I might want to watch the rest of this thing. And it's this fantastic physical comedian named Freddie Frinton in these, and you can look this up on YouTube and look up Dinner for One, Freddie Frinton. And you see the sketch comedy, and it was absorbing and funny, but I was going through some stuff in my life of having to say goodbye to a relative. And I was like, it's only funny because it's also heartbreaking and true and authentic. So I saw this whole piece in my head. And so we took this 9-minute sketch and have made an hour long show out of it that involves the slapstick comedy and the celebration at New Year's Eve. And there's a it's a two-person piece, but it also has another two people on stage, of a violinist and a pianist, and they live accompany the whole time. And it's just, it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun.
I'm kind of curious when I, because like I wasn't really familiar with Dinner for One, and I don't think a lot of Americans knew about it. I did look up like this fun New York Times article that was like 2 or 3-ish years ago. And I just think the New York Times, they throw the word Gen Z millennial like a little too often in terms of what was, but it did mention like how the internet is kind of like recapturing just like this very simple 18-12 minute sketch comedy into like kind of a weird cultural zeitgeist. Did that happen? Because like you found it through the Swedish Institute, but I don't know if there's like a bigger online presence now that's like kind of,
it definitely
it is.
And that article was so interesting. It came out right as we were closing the first year of the piece. So definitely, I do think, you know, it came out of our time of recovering of COVID and losing people. And we're all in this pattern of grief of what we thought our life was, what it is. How do you celebrate? Who's around you? It kind of captures this existential feeling of who's, how does memory play a part in where we're going and where we came from, but also who's a part of our memories. And so I do think in that, like, I totally agree with you. It's like, there's a lot in media, this throwing around of Gen Z, millennial, whatever you want to say, but really it is, culture is what people make of it. And in our culture right now, there's this mass reckoning, I think, of how do you find the joy in chaos? And how are we realistically? And I do think that there's a generation of folks who are rediscovering and remining things that are still pertinent to our experience right now. And that was essentially what we were inspired by. It's not a retelling. It's like, we don't reenact this sketch, but we are inspired by the events of this sketch. But it's one of many things where you look back and you get to look through history and you go, oh yeah, there, people have gone through some of these things before, and it resonates with me. And then there's a great generation right now that's finding these gems in this pile of media that we've started to amass now, you know?
Yeah. So. What I always thought was kind of interesting, especially for like comedy kind of ages not great. And slapstick is one of those things that's like, I think of like the Three Stooges. And my young, I had a younger, my younger cousin when he was like 6 or 8, just loved the Three Stooges along with his dad. They both just love like that slapstick kind of comedy. And there is something kind of like timeless, I think, with slapstick that just doesn't seem to age badly at all.
I mean, when you see someone and Jim Lickscheidl plays the role of James the butler in our production, and he's again one of those really gifted physical comedians, that I agree with you, there's a lot of comedy that, there's some comedy that relies on current state of affairs, and that is going to change. And but there's some comedy that relies on the awkwardness of being human. And I think the comedy that can last is if it's based in something that is eternal, which is how much you care for someone, how much you're willing to risk, and what you can learn. And I mean, like, it, not to make it all full of platitudes, but I do think that there's some comedy that it can last because it's inherently tapping into the stuff that doesn't change. And if it's real, and an audience can smell it when it's fake, and can smell it if you're pandering, and smell it if, you know, like, so you have to keep it based in the truth.
The other kind of question I was really curious about learning about this was, it is a 12 minute sketch, like originally anywhere between like 9 to 18 minute sketch. How did you make that into like a full-fledged hour-long production? What were like the biggest accomplishments, the biggest challenges, because it's like the premise is pretty simple, but how do you stretch that out into an hour and have the audience kind of not, I don't want to say not get bored, but like keep them entertained, keep them going.
Yeah, well, I mean, again, it goes back to like what's the truth of the matter? What is the heartfelt stuff that we didn't want to sacrifice? And again, when I saw this sketch, I like saw this, I saw in my mind's eye the show, the vibe. I knew music needed to be a really a big part of it. I knew the performers that I wanted to work with, which for the to be able to conceive it and co-create it, that was with Jim Lickscheidle and Sunmi Chaumette, and Emily Mettenbrink on violin, who acted as our music director. And so we met a couple, like 6 months before we started rehearsals, and we did some workshops of exploding kind of improv-based scenes of what we felt the core of the sketch comedy piece was about. And we knew that the physical humor was one of those like pillars of how to make it work. And so we set the stage of like, I just talked about the stage being a playground and those, the court, you know, the jungle gym is over here and the, you know, the swings are there. And you find like some basics of like how you simplify where this action happens. And then we just talked about like what was important, but then we just honestly like got in a room and tried to make each other laugh. And if the laugh could continue to happen after we've seen it, you know, time and time again, we knew that was something to build upon. And then with the cornerstone of of music, which can help you kind of feel something in a different way and go in another direction, we did that. But it definitely, there were challenges, but I never had any lack of faith for what these people could do, how I felt that the whole piece, because again, it's based in something real of a friendship, really. It's a New Year's Eve friendship story, that's very funny and wild. And one of those wild tenets of it is that we incorporate audience prompts, improv into the show. So, in four different instances during the piece, before the show, the audience is asked to give answers to a couple of questions, and then the characters draw from a bowl of these suggestions and incorporate them into the storytelling of the piece. So there's always an improv element that can vary and morph the show. You'll never see the same show twice.
Oh, that's interesting. That's so dynamic.
Yeah, and it's wild. I mean, it's very funny. Like you can hear in the audience when someone's
Oh, peace got
suggestion.
turned. Yeah. They're like, oh yeah, that was mine.
You're like, okay, E5, this is for you. This is for you. But it's wild. And you know, I was talking with some folks now that this has become their tradition because this is our third year doing it. And it's something that I think is fun because it is based in comedy, but there still is this heart to it, and but it's about the love of friendship and found family in the fact that, you know, you want to celebrate with meaning and be around people you like, and that's essentially all that this butler is trying to do is like help his friend through
Aww.
this whole thing. So, but he has some trouble. So, yeah, but the process was fun because I was also in a room with some really trusted colleagues and collaborators who knew the vibe of what we were trying to create and are very, very gifted playwrights and creators in their own stead. So the three of us together with Emilia contributing with music was something where we could, there was so much we actually cut from this
Oh
to keep it at an hour, because like there's tangents you could go on and we were like, oh no, that's not this show, that's not this show,
God.
let's keep this here. So who knows, maybe there will be a Dinner for One Part Two, The Reckoning.
Oh my gosh. I'm kind of curious when you mentioned like this is now starting to become people's like smaller holiday traditions. It like a lot of theaters, like I know I think like Children's has like How the Grinch or something like
Yeah.
that. Is this like what the idea for like the jungle's like, hey, we're gonna have this as our like our holiday tradition? Because it's in the third year, correct?
Yeah, third year, and I'm closing out my fifth year of being artistic director at the Jungle, going into my sixth year. And before that, I was working as associate artistic director and a resident director there. And I've been doing holiday shows at the Jungle now for 10 years.
Okay.
Where before this, we had a tradition that Sarah Rasmussen, the artistic director before me, had a great tradition of programming. There were pieces called Christmas at Pemberley, which were these Lauren Gunderson plays. There's a trilogy of plays that the Jungle helped commission for plays 2 and 3. And so this is, I do think people, especially in Minnesota, it's like you draw inward for the holidays and you want something to do when your families and friends are in town. And a lot of places, there's Christmas Carol, which is a tradition at the Guthrie and the Grinch over at CTC, and different places are finding these great ways to celebrate. And I've been doing a lot of holiday content, even at like Minnesota Orchestra. I was a part of some of their holiday productions. And for me, I think what was significant to us when I started programming Dinner for One was that I was looking for something too that was non-denominational and really got to the core of what it is, also in this winter solstice time of memory and the new year, and who's around us and who do we miss. And that is what drew me to the story, and that is what has, I think, has resonated with a lot of people, because you can still laugh and have a wild ride and feel like every age in your group is going to find something that speaks to them within this piece. And you're on your merry way making some more memories after that.
Yeah, and for like the third year in its production, are there like any big changes that you anticipate? The improv as well from the audience. Have there been any changes for the productions that you're excited to see for the season or?
Yeah, we continue to refine it every year. I mean, this is our third year, and we have a great group of collaborators and designers and folks who make it happen. And so I'm excited to get that back on stage. The most significant change this year is that Sunmi Chaumette will not be returning to reprise her role as Miss Sophie, but I will be actually stepping in to play Miss Sophie this year, which I've. You know, it's going to be fun, and but it's going to be wild, man. So, and the most the cool significant change on this is that we have another set of actors, Joy Dolo and Tyson Forbes-Lean, who will be playing another Miss Sophie. Oh, hey, Miss Sophie and James, the butler. So we have two teams of Sophie and James that are going to be, it's on our calendar on the website. If you check that out, you can see who's on deck for each performance. But holidays are, it's a robust time, and we wanted to make sure, like, Sunmi couldn't join us because she has family needs calling her away this year. And we wanted to make sure that it was something that, well, is something that our actor teams get to share in. And so we act as each other's understudies, but we also have some time to be able to restore. So it'll be fun. So those are like the biggest changes this year. And it's going to be a wild ride. I'm really looking forward to it.
Are you kind of nervous about playing Miss Sophie? 'Cause
Oh,
yeah.
yeah, Emma.
That
Yes, I am, because I am nervous about it. I think also because Sunmi and who and the character she created, I'm stepping into big shoes. She created a very iconic character in her own way, and so it'll be one of those things where Joy and I both, will have a chance now to kind of figure out what Miss Sophie looks like in other versions. And this has traveled, Last year, this was performed out in Boston at Greater Boston Stage. They did a production of Dinner for One out there. So there are have been multiple iterations of a Miss Sophie and a James. But definitely, I want to make sure it's just fun. And the only nervousness I have is sometimes too, is like wearing those multiple hats of directing and being on stage is there's different responsibilities, but we have a great team of support and people who will say, Christina, get off book and be funnier. So
I'm kind of curious about the, because we got mentioned a little bit earlier in this conversation about music. And yeah. I'm curious, how'd you collaborate with the musicians? What kind of pieces? Just kind of more the in-depth of the creative process for why music in this in Dinner for One, instead of just like kind of, I don't want to say like slapsticky kind of like vaudeville, like kind of weird sound effects. Why the instrumentation?
Right, right. Well, I think because I think at the core of this piece, you have to have, for me, it's about, it's only, there's slapstick, but then there's classical music, and those extremes actually help each other. And I think that's how it is for a real human, right? You're laughing to break up, you know, if you have had some tears, like that you, they both exist in the same person and oftentimes in the same, you know, 5 minutes. So for me, I think extremes help tell a more authentic tale. So I wanted to ground the slapstick with something that could deepen the experience. So for me, and again, it's like, as soon as I saw this, I like started, I not in a weird way, but I could just, I could imagine the feeling of this and the music that was there. And so working with Emilia was fantastic, because I could approach her and say, ooh, this piece, you know, we would share pieces back and forth, and we'd work on sections when we were doing that workshop time. And I would say, okay, this should have this kind of feeling. And we knew the instrumentation was violin and piano, so that kind of tells you some of the bulk of the work. But there's like a Fritz Kreisler piece that kind of bookends this piece called Midnight Bells, that is lovely and sweeping and virtuosic, but there's also, you know, there will be some other pieces in there that you'll kind of recognize and you know, vaguely familiar with, that that are that contain some meaning. There's a way in which we incorporate Auld Lang Syne into the piece that is lovely, and so I, for me, I think because people are all of the things at once, it didn't feel like a far reach to include classical music into this, because those things exist together and they can help each other express things that you didn't know were there.
Huh. Yeah, I never really would have thought of that. That's actually a really cool, that's a very good, it's a very interesting take on classical music into like a slapstick, because I always thought of like classical music as like very, as like stuffy environments, like operas, not something like the butler tripping over a rug would ever like kind of, I'm never like put those two together.
Yeah, well, and I think like we're in a time too where it's like we need to, just as we were talking earlier in the conversation about like that the younger generation mining a lot of the more authentic things that have inherent current resonance. Mm-hmm. I do think that in America, we've kind of been taught to about classical music and opera, and I've had a career in some of those fields, where somehow we have to put our gloves on and handle it with care, like it's this rare antiquity. And the best experiences I've had in those realms of classical music have been when you actually are kind of like getting under the hood, mm-hmm. and tinkering with it and really feeling, because at one point that music was new to someone. So it's the same principle of what can we draw from it, of why this piece speaks to us, what is about it that feels eternal, and also those highs and lows of like, if you have something that sounds a little highfalutin, but you have someone tripping over a rug and spilling a drink, it's funny. So,
so I just have one final question here before we wrap up. It's kind of standard, but where would you like to see this play go? Would you like to see other theaters do this kind of production, kind of almost adopt it as its little holiday tradition as well?
For sure. I mean, I think it's a piece that we envision to have a life beyond us. Okay. And like I said before, I went to out to Greater Boston Stage, and there were some great performers out there that I had a great chance to see. But also because it has different worlds within it, it has slapstick comedy, it has classical music, it has a great story. It's intimate enough that it can be done in small spaces, but big enough that it could happen in large spaces as well. So we've done work to make this something that could travel to other theaters, become a tradition for other places, but also maybe classical music venues. Maybe if there's folks who are, you know, chamber orchestras or things like that, we have an idea for how that could be. And it's an hour long. It's like the perfect size. You can have dinner with your loved ones and go see a weird show and write your suggestions and go off into the night to make your own memories.
Oh my God. Thank you so much for joining with me today, Christina Baldwin. Just a reminder for folks listening, Dinner for One will be performing at the Jungle Theater from December 6, 2025 to January 4th, 2026. Tickets can be found at thejungletheater.org. Start to make your new holiday tradition for Dinner for One. And then bring your
right.
family.
That's right, Emma. We want to see you.
Yeah. Thank you so much again.
Thanks, Emma.